Some of my most vivid childhood memories in Toledo take place in the peristyle, the cavernous concert hall built after the style of the Greeks, tucked humbly away in a corner of the Toledo Museum of Art. I, alongside dozens of other children in crisp white shirts and ties of subtly sequined black dresses, would file in the carriage entrance, what today we'd simply call the back door. Yes, that was me playing the Prokofiev Violin Concerto No. 2 at the Peristyle. Toledo's classical music scene was the backdrop of my childhood, the set on which some of my most stress-inducing and proudest moments alike took place. The appraising eyes of my teacher when he'd find out just how much I'd practiced, or not, that week. The utter dismay of completely blanking during an audition, the applause following my first solo concerto on that gorgeous peristyle stage. All of these moments remain seared into my memory. Those spaces and the soundscapes they echoed shaped me more than I could have possibly known at the time, and, though distant, they still make me who I am. Looking back, I realized those moments on the stage were the culmination of practice, yes, and hard work, yes, but most of all, sacrifice, and not even my own. As tangible to me as the moments on the stage is the tiny 1/8 size violin my parents bought on eBay when I was 6. The sheet music copied from borrowed library collections, the hours my mom spent teaching me, even though, while she loved music, she herself couldn't play violin. My parents didn't have much, but they gave me themselves in every lesson, every practice, every concert, every song. After months of practice, those final moments under the spotlight required as much courage and belief as it did skill, and I have my parents to thank for that. So when the applause came, it felt like an immense, breathtaking reward, not just for me, but for us. Welcome to the Midstory Hour, a show produced by Midstory in collaboration with WGTE. I'm your host, Samuel Chang. Here at Midstory, we believe in the power of storytelling, especially about the places we call home. We've covered thousands of stories from across all 12 Midwest states, and each week on the Midstory Hour, we will share a few with you. Tune in every Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m. to learn something new about the place you call home. And likewise, learn something new about places you've never been. This week, listen to the fourth episode of Midstory's brand new podcast, Brain Drain, to take a deep dive into the difficult and complex decision to leave home, or likewise, to stay. Next, our writers bring to you a story about a little-known building designed by a big-name architect, Frank Gehry. The entire structure was moved across the country, and to this day, its exact location remains a mystery. Finally, we're bringing you some bonus content that highlights objects from Made in Toledo, an interactive online exhibit on Toledo's industrial and manufacturing history, produced in collaboration with the Toledo History Museum. If you enjoy this program, Be sure to listen to other episodes and check us out at midstory.org or on our socials. Secret that post-industrial cities like Toledo are struggling with depopulation. What are the reasons people leave? And what would convince them to stay? To answer these questions, we interviewed dozens of Toledoans, people who've left, people who've stayed, and everyone in between. Today, we're bringing you the next episode of Brain Drain, a new series from the team at Midstory. It's a podcast 7 years in the making, and at the core of why we came home. Episode 4 takes a dive into Toledo's art scene, bringing you firsthand narratives of Toledoans in pursuit of creative careers, some building a way for it here, some leaving for it elsewhere, and then some taking a returning look at Toledo as a place worth taking a gamble on. Learn more about this podcast, explore data visuals, and tune in to future episodes at www.midstory.org/braindrain. Looking at your eyes,
kind of heaven eyes. This is Martin Barreto on the mic. Closing both my eyes. Waiting for surprise. Martin's one of our interns, and this is from his trip to interview Robert Koenig, the director of the Toledo School for the Arts. Martin can hardly wait for the interview. You can hear the excitement in his voice. I'd like to go there. Take me right away. He finds a parking spot.
Free parking?
And then heads inside. After wrapping up the interview, Martin drives back to the office.
I think I'm going the wrong way back to the office.
Or at least he tries to.
I'm going the wrong way. Okay, well.
Eventually, he did find his way back.
You know, I guess I'm not as much of a local Toledo as maybe I thought. I don't know how to find my way around here.
I promise I won't tell anyone that you got lost in your own hometown. Could you introduce yourself to our listeners?
I'm Martin Barreto. I'm Martin Barreto. I go to Syracuse University. I'm a senior. I'm originally from Cleveland, Ohio, but I moved to Toledo when I was 5 years old, and I've been here ever since. When I was in high school, I went to St. Francis, which is right down the road from where we're recording right now in Toledo. And when I was in high school, I wanted to leave Toledo. I didn't want to stay here. I didn't feel like I could achieve the things that I wanted to achieve while I was in Toledo.
Like many young people in the region, Martin looked elsewhere for his college experience. But this past summer, he returned home for an internship with Midstory. The program brings 25 college students from across the country to Toledo. Martin, the group's unofficial tour guide, made sure everyone got a taste of the local culture.
What was it like showing them this place that you've grown up in?
I think it was surprising to me, and it revealed things about my own views of Toledo that I think I may have taken for granted. There were things in Toledo that I didn't realize were as cool as they were, including things like the metro parks, including things like the zoo, the Toledo Museum of Arts, that I had kind of forgotten about, and forgotten that they were great, you know, that they had this really cool kind of value. So in showing the other interns around, I remembered how cool Toledo was, really.
Welcome to Brain Drain, a brand new Midstory production that presents an average American city through the eyes of the people who've left it behind. I'm Yannick Schaller. Episode 4. We gotta fight for our right to play smooth jazz. Martin isn't the only one who thinks Toledo's cool. Jake Vrieslar is from Oregon, Ohio, a suburb just east of the city, and works in video production. He now lives in New York, but we'll get to that part of the story later. Jake loved being a creative in Northwest Ohio.
I never saw myself leaving Ohio, basically. And so, because it just like, it wasn't really an option like presented to me when I was younger by my family, like not maliciously, just more like, I think my whole family lives in Northwest Ohio. So like, it was kind of just like, this is where we all are. This is what we do. And so I was kind of like, oh yeah, I have to like make this career work here.
Jake left the Toledo area for school and attended Taylor University, a small liberal arts college in Indiana, not too far from home.
It was kind of still abiding by this like acceptance thing that I had of like, I'm going to stay in the Midwest and make this work.
Jake did have a short stint in Los Angeles through a Hollywood internship program at Taylor, but didn't feel like he wanted to stay there. Aside from differences in politeness and rush hour traffic, Jake felt a heightened level of creative competition in Los Angeles. His eyes were open to the reality of what it meant to be in a space where creative-minded people weren't the odd ones out.
You grow up kind of being the special person in the flock, which is like, oh, this guy makes videos. Like, he's different than everyone else. Like, he's doing something different. And I felt so unique by that. And then now I'm in a place where it's like, you go to like Starbucks and like you order something from the barista, and the barista's like, by the way, I'm like a director. And you're like, wait a second, like everyone is after this exact same thing that I'm after. And that pressure was a kind of disarming, but also very exciting. And I was like, oh wow, this is like, I actually want to be super good. Like, I want to be better than these people. and I want to get jobs, you know, and I want to work on movies. And so I think that's, while I didn't like LA, that's kind of what LA did for my mindset.
His Hollywood internship might not have sold him on LA, but it still planted the idea in his head that he might find more success somewhere with better creative competition and artistic networks. He currently lives and works in New York City, where a substantial artistic community drives his work further.
If I had to make a hypothesis about what the difference between like the competition in New York is versus in Toledo, like I think the main thing, like especially, and I did experience this too when I was like trying to, you know, like make film production work there, is I don't think there's a huge collective like celebration of the arts. I think because of like the, you know, the economy that exists in that area, it is like very centered on engineering and like all these are also noble jobs, so I'm like not trying to bash them, but like it's like there's such a focus on blue collar work that I think the idea of a young filmmaker or young artist of any kind getting their start or like, you know, being able to have a career in their work being from Toledo, I think is like really the disadvantage, you know, because it's like, okay, but you got to actually get a real job. I think I would have landed here at some point, no matter what. And the version of me staying in the Midwest, I think it would have just ended in like, I feel like I'm not reaching far enough. Like, I think that's kind of where I would hit the wall.
Despite the access and pace that New York gave him, Jake dreams to one day create a film that can tap into his uniquely Midwestern identity. In other words, he still wants to come back home. But is Toledo ready to receive him? The city has a long history of commitment to the arts and artists. In 1941, the city hosted the first American performance of The Nutcracker and has performed it without fail every year since. In 1977, it was the first city in Ohio to adopt the 1% for Art program, which requires 1% of the city's capital improvement budget to be set aside specifically to support public arts. In 2022, Toledo officially became home to the largest mural in the United States, which features sunflowers and portraits of members of the Miami, Shawnee, and Dakota tribes. The mural spans 28 grain silos along the Maumee River. Toledo also boasts major arts organizations, like the Arts Commission, which paid over $600,000 directly to local artists and supported over 40 local organizations in 2024. In 2019, the city's symphony and ballet merged, with the jazz orchestra joining them 5 years later to form what is now Live Arts Toledo. The organization recently completed a multi-million dollar renovation of the iconic Masonic Temple in South Toledo, where the region's arts come together in one space. All told, Live Arts Toledo hosts more than 200 live performances and reaches nearly 15,000 students each year in Northwest Ohio. Toledo is investing heavily in the arts, too. A newly released Ohio Creative Economy report reveals that Northwest Ohio's creative sector supports nearly 14,000 jobs, generates $789 million in worker income, and adds $1.2 billion in value to our regional economy. But is that investment making it easier for local artists to stay in town? Alyssa Brutlag grew up in Toledo, and from a young age, she's loved the art of dance.
It's always been a part of my life, yeah. Training and going to school, I found that I was happiest after school in my dance life, like at the studio. Like, I was always excited to go to dance. It was my happy place.
Her professional dance ambitions soon followed.
In about junior year of high school, I decided, like, okay, I don't know how to really make a career in this or what I want to do, but I know that this is what I'm happiest doing.
But she felt that she couldn't both stay and pursue her artistic goals, so she left to attend Western Michigan University. After school, Alyssa went to Seattle for a job opportunity that she'd gotten because of the work she did at WMU. But the COVID-19 pandemic brought her back home.
I lost all my work opportunities out there, especially because dance is so social and relies on human connection, and it's hard to do that virtually.
She spent 3 years back in Toledo teaching dance, but there was still an itch to go elsewhere, to a place with more opportunities for those who want to make a name for themselves in the arts.
I just felt like as I was getting older, I felt like I needed to give myself that second shot to kind of try to move away again, because I felt like I was kind of in a bubble, and I have big goals to do big things in dance, and I felt like no one in Toledo like could get me there, or maybe I didn't have the mentors around or even the peers around to make that happen. So I decided that I'm going to take this leap. I have nothing holding me back. I'm going to move to Chicago.
And Alyssa found just what she'd been searching for.
I feel like there's a thriving dance scene in Chicago. There's a ton of professional dancers. I have a network out here. I have friends that are dancing professionally. I didn't even have that in Toledo, like not one friend that was a professional. And if they were there, they were leaving in a couple months, you know? So there's an audience here. There's a dance show every weekend I can go to. Actually, there's like I'm picking between 3 shows I want to see this weekend in the city. So I think there's an audience.
That's something she says she didn't find as much of in Toledo.
To be frank, like the thing I was lacking was funding and an audience. Like, I don't think that Toledo has an interest in watching dance. I don't think that the theaters in the area really present much dance. I think you have to go to Detroit to see dance, and even that is, I mean, that's a barrier in itself.
The economic realities of Toledo can undermine the ideals of artists, like in the city's theater community. Robert Koenig is the director of the Toledo School for the Arts, but he spends his free time pursuing other local creative endeavors. He sits on the board of the Toledo Repertoire Theater. That role has shown him how much love this city has for theater, but also the difficulties of putting on a production here.
I would say most, I would say 95, 98% of actors that are doing musical theater or theater generally in Toledo have a full-time job, and they're doing this at night. And they're doing it for free, and they're doing it because they love it. I've been associated with the Toledo Rep for years. And We have tried to hire union actors in some of our productions, and it's just cost prohibitive. Because, you know, in the Toledo Rep, our tickets are $24, $28. And because of the size of the house, it just, you wouldn't even break even if you did that.
Toledo is not New York, and it's not Chicago. That means a thriving art scene in this historically blue-collar, post-industrial city may not include sold-out theatrical performances, multiple dance showcases per weekend, or Hollywood-level film funding. But the arts have been woven into the fabric of the city in ways that are uniquely, well, Toledo. Take the Toledo School for the Arts, an arts-focused charter school. It inhabits a former Willie's Overland finishing plant in downtown Toledo. Students there haul bulky tubas and timpanis up a massive freight elevator that once transported Jeeps to an automobile showroom on the first floor. That showroom is now an art gallery where students get experience in marketing and business, something Koenig says helps prepare them for the real world.
I think that we as a school do a pretty good job of creating well-rounded individuals where they can go out and pursue whatever they want to pursue. They develop the ability to ascertain that there's a challenge or problem, understand what the problem is, and then come up with a reasonable response to that problem. That kind of logic and that kind of thinking is absolutely needed every day, in my opinion, in the business world. People that don't do that, they're going to be left behind.
An education in the arts, Koenig argues, shapes young people to be better suited for many different sectors of the professional world. But the reverse also holds true. Diverse and interdisciplinary backgrounds help make the arts more successful in a place like Toledo. Koenig himself used his experience in construction law to help renovate the TSA, making the building and the art inside it more accessible to everyone. Rather than trying to make Toledo fit for the arts, Koenig wants to foster an art scene that's fit for Toledo. And he's got company.
If we could just start with like a blanket, like introduction for you, your title, who you are.
Yeah. Adam Levine, director of the Toledo Museum of Art. And most importantly for this interview, not from Toledo, born and raised New Yorker, lived here 12 of 14 years. And think anyone who doesn't want to be here is totally missing the plot.
Adam calls himself an unrepentant evangelist for Toledo. And coming from someone who grew up in New York City, a place that is much more accustomed to unrepentant evangelizing, that statement certainly has some heft to it. Adam loves Toledo so much that he actually moved here twice. The first time was in 2014, when he came to town fresh out of grad school at Cambridge. Adam started as the head of visitor engagement at the Toledo Museum of Art, eventually working his way up to deputy director and curator of ancient art. After leaving in 2018 to be the new director of an art museum in Jacksonville, Florida, he returned to the Glass City again in April of 2020 to become the 11th director of the TMA. I asked Adam to tell me a bit more about why he's so gung-ho for Toledo and what it is about the city's artistic community that speaks to him.
I am continuously impressed by the number of artists, the quality of the work that they're producing, and the ability that, you know, the economy provides for artists to do more work than maybe in other parts of the United States. And I've got news for everyone listening. Toledo's a lot more like the United States than New York or LA. And in a lot of ways, more like the world, because we have like an astonishing amount of plurality here. Right? A third of the museum's visitors are Democrats, a third are Republicans, and a third are independents. Like, we have a very peculiar place in Northwest Ohio that is very special and is like a much more interesting laboratory for like the challenges of the 21st century than some of these other cities. If your model of success is whether you can get Laotian food at 3 a.m., then Toledo will not hit that threshold, right? But I think that there are a lot of things that Toledo offers in terms of like really interesting opportunities. So I think a lot of this is just positioning. And I think a lot of it is what incentive structures can we introduce that allow people to take the risks required for our community to take a leap forward.
Risk is a key concept for Adam, which is slightly unusual for the director of an art museum that's more than a century old. But I think it'd be fair to say that it's one of the hallmarks of his tenure with the TMA. and it informs much of his thinking on how to address the challenges the museum and the city at large are currently facing.
And as we elaborate this conversation on quote unquote brain drain, I think it's really important that we distinguish between whether there is intellectual capital and human capital in Toledo, which there is, versus whether there's intellectual or human capital that is in a position or has the willingness to take the risks that are required to turn singles into home runs, because those are different things.
To extend Adam's baseball metaphor, let's take a look at some of his recent at-bats. Has the TMA been able to turn singles into home runs? In the years following the worst of the pandemic, when restrictions were lifted and America crawled back towards normalcy, the TMA was faced with the same sluggish attendance numbers that arts institutions across the country were dealing with. Adam saw this challenge as a chance to do things differently. In rebuilding the TMA's attendance, the museum had the opportunity to influence not just how many people passed through its front doors, but also who those people happened to be. The Toledo Museum of Art has consistently ranked highly for visitations per capita. The world-class museum, by the way, is free to the public thanks to a generous endowment from Toledo's original glass tycoons, the Libbys. Despite this, when Adam took a closer look at the numbers, he found that visitation was under-indexed within 2 miles of the museum itself. In other words, while the TMA continued to attract people from across the city, it wasn't doing the best job of welcoming visitors from its own backyard. In order to fix that, Adam and his team have developed a strategy that is tailored to the folks living within that 2 mile radius.
The way you get people who have not necessarily considered visiting a museum to visit a museum isn't through messaging, it's through relationship building. It's all about relationships. And what we've had to do is we've had to form these relationships from scratch in many cases. And the way we've done so has been through repeatedly showing up in community. And I don't mean like, you know, periodically. I mean, the same person shows up at the same place, the same time every week. So that is a replicable model, not a scalable model. So that's what we've been doing within 2 miles, and we hope to expand it. It's a relatively cost-intensive model, but the proof is in the pudding.
Before Adam launched this relationship-building campaign, only 6% of the TMA's visitors came from within that 2 mile circle. Now, that percentage is up to 22%, right in line with the proportion of the city's population that lives in the area. During Adam's time in charge of the TMA, total visitation has increased by 10 to 15% in each year following the pandemic. Adam admits that it's not necessarily a model that's especially scalable or cost-effective, but it seems to be paying off. The TMA is not just in post-pandemic recovery mode, it's actively reshaping its attendance, building towards an audience that is more and more representative of Toledo. Adam believes that in order to grow an artistic community here that lasts, it needs to be true to the rhythm of this city. Plus, he thinks Toledo's Rust Belt identity can be a calling card, not a handicap.
Because I'll tell you what, in my limited experience, in my role, people are thirsty to not fun things on the coasts. Right. And I know I'm preaching to the choir here. I don't need to tell people at mid-story, right, that there's interesting stuff happening in the middle and the middle is worthy of investment. Right. So I think that there are a lot of unconscious biases in the assumption that you have to do interesting things on the coast. And by the way, you know, there are some exceptional things in markets you wouldn't expect, right? Dayton's contemporary dance scene is like as good as any in the country, right? Dayton's the same size as Toledo.
Adam's mention of dance reminded me of Alyssa Brutlag, the dancer we heard from earlier in this episode, who eventually decided to leave Toledo because she felt that her professional and artistic aspirations had outgrown the city. So I told him about her. He was quick to commend her for putting in real effort to create the artistic environment of her dreams in this city, and didn't want to suggest that he held anything against her for making the choice that she did. But what he did say is that, maybe, the work that's required to create a stable and rewarding arts infrastructure in a city like Toledo is a little bit different from what's required of a professional performing artist.
Expertise on dance and expertise in an art form and expertise in teaching an art form is different than expertise in audience development. Like, two things can be true. To say, like, there isn't an audience and a place for a thing or a sufficient audience to make your model work is legitimate. At the same time, that it's possible that the audience wasn't developed optimally, right? And so, like, a good idea variably executed is still a good idea.
Alyssa had a good idea. What she didn't have was enough people around her to support her in turning that good idea into a vivid reality right here in Toledo. So she left for Chicago, where she would be certain to brush elbows, bump shoulders, and catch eyes.
Sometimes you can just get lucky because there's so much kinetic energy in a place because it's big enough and there's enough capital or enough people with like-minded interests that like you don't have as much performance risk because it could just kind of work out, right? Like I do think if you're going to try something novel in Toledo, it's got to be executed perfectly.
Maybe not everyone can afford to execute things perfectly. Most local artists don't have the same safety net that a major institution with an endowment does. But Adam's certainly taking a risk by betting big on Toledo and on the value of a museum that tries to be representative of its city.
I am all in on Toledo. And one of the reasons why I've become all in on Toledo is that while Toledo has challenges, the scale of the challenges are solvable. And I think that there comes a point in sort of everyone's life where they realize the cavalry is not coming, that you are it, right? So we have this very wise trustee who said to me, and I guess this is a thing that is well known, but I had never heard it before, that to mix metaphors, the grass is greener where you water it. And I appreciate all of the heartfelt reasons people feel like Toledo may not be the place for them in a certain chapter in their life. But I also think there's a type of person who sees Toledo and is very excited that it can be made into the type of place that that very same person would want to be. And I think Toledo has an opportunity to recruit those people. And when I say recruit, I don't mean from the outside. I mean to keep people, right, who want to build that thing here.
Martin, could you, because you spent a lot of time this summer looking into institutions like the museum and other cultural institutions around the city, do you still have that same impression of what the artistic community in Toledo is like and what purpose it serves for the city?
My view of the Toledo arts culture now is very, very different. And I think, you know, we talked about how in showing the other interns around Toledo, I kind of was able to step out of myself and have a different view of the city. And looking back on it, my involvement in the arts in Toledo was much more than I even kind of realized when I was a kid. I did like musical theater. I was an Annie when I was like in middle school and stuff like that. And this is kind of things that I sort of took for granted, but they were done through institutions at Toledo. And I did like summer camps at the Imagination Station, which were arts related. Had a lot of programs and field trips through the Toledo Museum of Arts where I learned like a bunch of cool stuff about arts history. And these are things that weren't advertised to me as being important things. I wish I didn't feel like that. I wish other Toledoans didn't feel like that because Toledo's arts culture has really shaped me as a person and who I am. And it, as somebody who, you know, enjoys the arts, enjoys things like creative writing and film, Toledo has had a big impact on me. I wish perhaps I hadn't taken it for granted.
Brain Drain is a mid-story podcast written and hosted by Dea Kukeli and by me, Yannick Schaller. Additional reporting on this episode by Martin Barreto. Our editors are Logan Sander and Samuel Chang. Sound design and engineering on this episode is by yours truly. Original artwork for the series by Ruth Chang and Joshua Rep. Data analysis by Chai Satsue, Anna Diasio, and Itong Jiang. Fact-checking by Terry Brisky. Special thanks go to our lovely team of interns who call Toledo home for, at least, a summer. Anavi Prakash, Yasu Shinazaki, Rajan Carson, Martin Barreto, and Desiree Lua. For more information, research, and reading material, please check out the show notes for this episode, available at midstory.org/braindrain. If our reporting has struck a chord or a nerve, we want to hear from you. Reach us on social media or via email at braindrain@midstory.org. Thanks for listening.
enjoyed this podcast episode? Brain Drain and the many stories produced by MidStory are made possible in part by listeners like you. To support Midwest Stories and help us uplift our home, check us out at midstory.org or on our socials. If you're just joining us now, you're currently listening to the MidStory Hour. Tune in every Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m. to hear hidden stories from Toledo, the Midwest, and beyond. You can also find this podcast on midstory.org/themidstoryhour or wgte.org/themidstoryhour or wherever you get your podcasts. It's rare for a house to move once, let alone two times. Yet, that's exactly what happened to the Winton Guest House, a key work of architect Frank Gehry, who died last December. Originally built in Minnesota, the house was first moved within the state, a lengthy process. Then, just a few years after that first move, the house was sold at auction and transported more than 1,000 miles to the Hudson Valley, its exact location known only to a select few. Fellow Celia Johnson set out to learn what it takes to relocate a house that was never meant to move. She discusses the house and its enduring legacy with MidStory's Yaffa Siegel.
So recently, I've been researching a pretty interesting building. In the early 1980s, Frank Gehry constructed a guest house in Wayzata, Minnesota, which was his first project in a cold climate. I mean, he mostly worked in California before then. Mm. But it helped build his reputation, and it sort of developed a unique story of its own.
So what inspired you to write about this?
You know, he's mainly known for his work in California and then overseas in buildings like the Guggenheim Bilbao and the Louis Vuitton headquarters. But I was curious, you know, what kind of impact did he have on the Midwest? And I discovered that actually he had quite a long history with particularly the state of Minnesota.
So in Minnesota, what did he end up doing?
So he first came to Minnesota when he was working for Victor Gruen. This was when he was a very young architect. He didn't yet have his own firm. Mm-hmm. He came to work on the Southdale Mall, which was one of the first indoor shopping malls in the country. Oh. And he liked Minnesota, I think. So when the Wintons, Penny and Mike Winton, who were this local couple, they were philanthropists, supporters of the arts. They wanted to build a guest house on mm-hmm. their property. And they already had this house designed by Philip Johnson, who was already on their property. It was very modernist, brick, L-shaped. They wanted a house, a guest house that would complement their main house rather than, you know, overtaking it, overshadowing it. Mm-hmm. And so they saw this profile of Gehry in the New York Times Magazine that was very complimentary of him. And they were like, we want to see if this guy could do a good job on it.
What sort of design did they end up coming up with?
Yes.
Sounds complicated.
Yeah, I think Gehry, you know, had challenges approaching the project at first because mm-hmm. he didn't know how to build a house that wouldn't compete with the Johnson house, you mm-hmm. know? But then he said in the speech later that eventually what he realized was that they wanted a piece of art rather than a house, really. I mean, they wanted a house, but they wanted a structure that would be both. And so the kind of design they eventually developed is just that. It looks like a sculpture as much as it functions as a house.
So what makes it sculptural? Like, can't anything be a sculpture?
Well, that's very fair. One of the really unique things about the house is that it has these six distinct segments, and they really are distinct.
So it's in a bunch of different pieces.
Yes. Yeah. I actually spoke to John Cook, who helped design the original house. And he said that, you know, Gehry basically wanted it to look like aliens might have set each piece of the house down on the lawn. The biggest room, which is in the middle, is the living room. And that's metal. Mm-hmm. And it has this big pyramid on top, has a skylight. And then all the other sort of segments sort of rotate around that living room. So there's two bedrooms, one of which is clad in limestone, which came from Mankato, Minnesota. And then the other one is also metal, so that matches the living room. And then there's a kitchen, which is also sort of a garage. Mm-hmm. And that is in like a sort of aluminum and finished plywood pattern. Gehry really liked finished plywood as like a pre-made material. Mm. And then there's a loft above the kitchen garage. So the Wintons really wanted this house in particular for their grandchildren.
Oh, okay.
And the loft was intended to be like their play space. So that was really fun. And then the last segment is this fireplace room, which was actually made from the same brick that was used in the Johnson house, in the main house on the property. And so Gary was trying to symbolize, you know, the connection between the two houses. They're not competing against each other. They're working in harmony by using that same material.
Oh, that's really interesting. I like how he used stuff like from the area for the materials to build the house. So can I go see it? This sounds really awesome.
Well, unfortunately, you can't because the house has been moved not once, but twice.
Twice.
You know, the Wintons had, you know, a good decade of use of the house. Mm. Their grandchildren came. They loved it. But then eventually they decided they wanted to move. I believe they moved to Minnesota to an apartment building. So they just wanted a change of scenery.
Mm.
And so they sold the whole land that both houses were on to this local developer. And he subdivided it into three pieces, you know, one for each house and then one that was undeveloped. And he was able to sell the undeveloped piece of land and the Johnson house pretty easily. Mm. But he had a really hard time finding someone to buy the Winton house, I think, you know, in part because it was a guest house. And it is, you know, it has this heavy focus on aesthetics. So it is functional, but it's not as functional.
I mean, it was meant to be a little weird looking.
Right. So. Exactly. Exactly. So the house sat unsold for quite a few years. And then eventually the developer, Kurt Woodhouse, started thinking, you know, maybe I will donate the house.
Oh, who would want that?
Well, that's a great question. So he looked for a lot of people who were interested in accepting, and eventually he found one organization that was that wanted to buy in. And it was the University of St. Thomas, which is a university based in the Twin Cities. And they wanted to accept the house and, you know, show it off as a piece of architectural history.
Hmm.
But the catch was that Woodhouse wasn't giving them the land and the house.
Right.
He was only giving them the house.
That sounds like a problem.
Yeah. So, you know, when Gary built this house, he never thought that they would have to move it, but moving it was just what they had to do. So they hired this guy named Larry Stubbs, who has a bit of a reputation in the Minneapolis area because he and his company moved the Schubert Theater, which was a historic building. They moved it on wheels a quarter mile in the early 90s, I believe.
Okay.
And so they were like, Stubbs is the guy for the job. And he accepted it thinking it would be not so hard. Mm. It turned out to be pretty hard.
Sounds hard.
Yeah. So they had to break the house into eight pieces, I believe.
Oh.
And then each piece had to go on a truck. And then it was transported to Owatonna, Minnesota, which is where the University of St. Thomas had this conference center that they owned. They had some land available to reconstruct the house on. And they had to drive very slowly.
Right.
And mostly at night. And mostly during good weather. So it ended up taking them years to move the house because they had to have these perfect conditions.
Right.
And then they had to reconstruct the house.
Mm-hmm.
So then it reopened at the University of St. Thomas, and it served as an educational exhibit. There was like information installed inside about the Wintons, about Gary, who at this time had progressed in his career to becoming quite famous. And I mean, all was well.
Yeah. All was well, right?
Until...
Oh, no.
The university announced that they had to sell the conference center, so it just wasn't financially viable for them. Mm. And so where was the house going to go? So Victoria Young, who's a professor of art history at the university and who sort of became, found herself the steward of this house, was really determined to save it from being taken down and going into storage forever, you know?
Yeah.
That would be really a loss.
Would it have gone into storage or would it have just been...
I think... optimistically, it would have gone into storage. But, you know, who would have ever chosen to put it up again is a great question.
Yeah. Where would you keep it?
So instead, she arranged for it to be auctioned, like a piece of art, like a painting, or like a small sculpture. And it was bought by a private buyer. And the private buyer decided that they wanted to move the house again. Well, they had to move the house again because the land was being sold.
Right.
But this buyer didn't want to just move it. So Wayzata to Owatonna was about 100 miles. That was already took them years, right?
Yeah.
But this buyer wanted to move it a little bit further than that, all the way to the Hudson Valley in New York State.
Oh, boy.
So John Cook, who was involved in building the house originally, he was also involved in the second move.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me that originally they thought maybe they would float the pieces, you know, on the Great Lakes and then down the Hudson River.
Oh.
But eventually they determined... Eventually they determined that would be a little bit too expensive and it would be more cost effective to bring the pieces by land. Mm-hmm. And so I believe the tower, the living room tower, did not make the trip. It was simply just too large. Oh. But all the other pieces were taken to the Hudson Valley. Mm-hmm. And there, you know, a new tower was reassembled.
Oh, I see.
And the house was put back together.
So they built a new one.
Like, yes.
Oh, okay.
So this actually happened the first time they moved the house as well. I believe the finished plywood garage kitchen had rotted. Oh. And so it is interesting because, you know, they are moving this house, but each time they're having to recreate a little bit more of it. It makes you think about, you know, the Ship of Theseus.
I was literally just thinking about the Ship of Theseus.
Yeah.
But I would say, based off of the two things that have changed, it's still mostly the original, right?
Yeah. And John Cook said something really interesting, which was that he actually saw the second move as a chance to optimize his designs, his and Gary's designs. You know, when they built this house, they had to think both about the aesthetics of these, you know, very slight connections between the sections that Gary wanted, but they also had to think about insulation and moisture barriers.
Because,
you know, Minnesota gets cold. Yeah. And Cook felt like there was room for improvement in the job they had done there. And so he made some tweaks to the designs. Gary signed off on it.
Okay.
And he said, you know, that the original house ended up feeling like a model for the eventual house he constructed. But, I mean, it is still undeniably an important part of his legacy, you know, which is why it was controversial, actually, the initial move from Wayzata to Owatonna, because some people felt like it had to stay in that one spot. But Young, who worked at the university, you know, told me she thought it was more important to save a piece of Frank Gehry's legacy, because otherwise it was probably going to be torn down. So, like, something is lost, but the building itself is still saved.
Yeah. And even if we can't see it anymore, it's still out there.
Right.
It's nice to know that it's still out there.
It's in an undisclosed location now.
Somewhere in the Hudson Valley.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Celia. It's been very interesting. I learned a lot about sculpture, learned a lot about form. Anything else you want to say before we sign off?
Yeah, I mean, I think the house ended up having a really interesting role to play in Gehry's rise to international acclaim, as some have described it. So like I said, the Wintons were prominent philanthropists in the Minneapolis area, and they helped Gehry get the commission to design the Weissman Art Museum in Minneapolis, which is a bit of a controversial building. It has been voted the ugliest building in Minneapolis by residents a couple times.
We're talking about it.
But yes, and it's the first building where you see those big steel curves that actually come to define Gehry's legacy. So if you think about the Walt Disney Concert Hall in L.A., if you think about the Guggenheim Bilbao, it's these computer-designed curves, and those came from the Weissman. And so you can sort of trace a line from the Winton House to the Weissman to these projects that really made him like a world-famous architect.
Thank you so much, Celia.
The Midstory Hour is a weekly radio show by Midstory, where we connect regional stories to national dialogues and feature behind-the-story conversations with Midstory's writers from across the nation. Tune in to WGTE on FM 91 every Saturday at 10 a.m. and find the podcast online at midstory.org/themidstoryhour and wgte.org/themidstoryhour or wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you're just joining us now, you're currently listening to The Midstory Hour. Tune in every Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m. to hear hidden stories from Toledo, the Midwest, and beyond. You can also find this podcast on midstory.org/themidstoryhour or wgte.org/themidstoryhour or wherever you get your podcasts. Next up is a recurring segment that's adapted from Made in Toledo, an interactive gallery we created in partnership with the Toledo History Museum.
Hey Celia, what did you bring to show me today?
Hi Evan. Well, the first item we're going to talk about today is a coffee wrapper from a brand with a really long history. So this is a coffee wrapper that belonged to Lion Coffee, which is a brand that was founded in 1864 in Toledo. It's actually believed to be one of the oldest trademarks in the United States. And Lion Coffee actually made a bunch of different innovations to the industry. So the first one was that it pre-roasted its beans. Before this, you bought your beans and then you brought them to your house and there you roasted them. And so Lion Coffee saved customers the hassle of doing that by pre-roasting the beans. They also ran a campaign where you could get free bags of coffee for sending in the packaging, which featured this big lion on it. So if you ever collected box tops for your school, it was sort of like that sort of campaign. And that was really new at the time. And then the third thing they did was they actually sold so much coffee that they forced the Postal Service itself to innovate. So because they were selling so many bags of coffee at once, the Postal Service decided to use weight instead of counting the number of bags to determine how much postage they owed. And that's still an approach that they use for bulk mail today.
Wow, coffee really changing a lot of things.
Yeah, the company did really well for a long time, but then eventually in the mid-1900s, the brand was liquidated and ceased to exist. But then something surprising happened. In 1979, there was a man named Jim Delano, and he was an entrepreneur, and he saw that the trademark of this iconic American brand was available because nobody had bought it and the rights had lapsed, and he revitalized Lion Coffee with one small difference, which is that instead of being based out of Toledo, Ohio, it's now based out of Hawaii. So wow. It's still a brand you can purchase today. And if you've ever, drunk Lion Coffee, you might associate it with Hawaii, but it actually has a long history here in Toledo.
Well, I'll have to try some. What do you have to show me next?
Well, the next item is pretty unusual. It's a small axe. It's made out of glass.
Okay.
It has a famous person's portrait engraved in it. Do you want to guess?
Benjamin Franklin?
Pretty close, actually. The axe has a picture of George Washington on it. And I guess I said engraved, but it's made out of glass, so it's a raised portrait on the axe. And it was created by the Libbey Glass Company, which is probably familiar to a lot of listeners. It was one of the biggest employers in the area around the turn of the century. And this axe was displayed at the World's Fair in 1893, which was held in Chicago over a period of some months. As you might imagine, it's an axe. It's made of glass. It's not designed to be used for cutting down trees. Instead, Libbey made it as a publicity stunt to show the public what glass was capable of doing. This wasn't the only stunt they pulled at the World's Fair. They also designed a dress and a parasol that were made from glass threads. The way you imagine that you spin thread, they would pull out really thin glass fibers that were still hot and basically wind them around a spool. That's pretty unusual. I wouldn't say people generally make dresses out of glass. And so that and a parasol made of glass were also displayed in the pavilion. As of 2022, the dress and the parasol were actually in the collection of the TMA as well. 2 million people came to visit the pavilion of Libbey during World's Fair, so it was a big success for their company. And they even made a replica dress for the daughter of Queen Isabella II of Spain, who visited the pavilion and fell in love with the dress.
Well, Cinderella had a glass slipper, but she certainly didn't have a glass dress. What do you have to show me next?
Well, the last item we're going to talk about today is the Conservo cooker. So if you use an Instant Pot today, the Conservo cooker is described as the predecessor to the Instant Pot. It was patented in 1907, and then it was sold in the Sears catalog for a couple of decades. Do you want to know how it works?
Yeah. How does it work?
All right. So it sits over one burner on your stove, and you add water through a pipe in the top, and the water goes down to the bottom of the cooker. And then you turn on the stove, it heats up, and then you latch it shut. And just like a modern Instant Pot, steam gets trapped inside and it pressurizes the cooker. And then the pressure cooks the food inside. It also had a handy dandy little whistle that told you if it was running out of water and you needed to refill it from the top. You could use it for cooking, like I said, steaming, and then a lot of people used it for canning. And the Conservo's design actually had two different compartments. And so the advertisements told people that they could both cook meals and can at the same time.
Wow.
So it was very useful for busy housewives.
Well, thanks for sharing. And next time, we'll have more items that were made in Toledo.
Thanks for listening to the Mid-Story Hour. We have a full lineup for our next episode. So tune in next Saturday at 10 a.m. to hear more about Mid-Story, our home and our greater region. If you have a story you'd like to share or just would like to drop us a note, please contact us at contact@midstory.org. We'd love to hear from you. Until next time, see you soon. The
Midstory Hour is a Midstory podcast produced in collaboration with WGTE. It features original work produced by our dedicated team of reporters, researchers, data analysts, and creators. This episode was hosted by Samuel Chang, edited by Evan Blanco, and written by Logan Sander, Ruth Chang, and Samuel Chang. Artwork is by Ruth Chang and Joshua Reb. This week's episode features stories by the Greater Midstory team, including Dea Kukeli, Yannick Schaller, Celia Johnson, and Yaffa Siegel. Midstory is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to progressing the Midwest narrative through multimedia storytelling, solutions-oriented research, and community programming. Founded in 2018 by four individuals who found their way home from the East Coast to Toledo, Ohio, Midstory re-envisions the Midwest story toward a productive, bright, and influential future. Learn more at www.midstory.org.